from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We are all aware of the tragedy that happened in Benghazi, where four Americans, including our ambassador there, Chris Stevens, was killed in an attack on a consulate office there. I said at the time that my absolute commitment was to make sure that we brought to justice those who had been responsible. And yesterday, our special forces, showing incredible courage and precision, were able to capture an individual, Abdul Qatala, who is alleged to have been one of the masterminds of the attack.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Tuesday, speaking at an event in Pittsburgh, announcing the capture of a man who was allegedly behind the September 11th, 2012 attack in Benghazi that killed four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador.
He is now being transported back to the United States. I say that, first of all, because we continue to think about and pray for the families of those who were killed during that terrible attack. But more importantly, it's important for us to send a message to the world that when Americans are attacked, no matter how long it takes, we will find those responsible and we will bring them to justice. And that's a message I sent the day after it happened, and regardless of how long it takes, we will find you. And I want to make sure that everybody around the world hears that message very clearly, because my first and most solemn duty as President and Commander-in-Chief is to keep the American people safe. And there are a lot of dangers out there and a lot of challenges, and our diplomats serve with incredible courage and valor in some very difficult situations. They need to know that this country has their back and will always go after anybody who goes after us.
According to reports, the suspect, Ansar al-Sharia commander Ahmad Abu Qatala, was captured Sunday inside Libya by U.S. forces and is en route to the U.S. for prosecution. We spoke Tuesday with former six-term congressional representative Cynthia McKinney about the arrest and about the U.S. involvement in Libya. We'll bring you that interview later in this newscast. Two journalists working for the Russian TV channel Rossiya were killed during a Ukrainian military shelling attack near Lugansk, eastern Ukraine. Reporter Igor Korneliuk passed away on the operating table, according to a doctor at the hospital, and Rossiya TV has also confirmed that sound engineer Anton Voloshin, who was working with Korneliuk, was also killed in the attack. Only one member of the three-person news crew, camera operator Viktor Denisov, survived the shelling by the Ukrainian military. Denisov later identified the bodies of both Voloshin and Korneliuk. The Russian Foreign Ministry issued a statement saying that Moscow expects world media outlets will strongly and unambiguously denounce, quote, this new crime by the Ukrainian security forces, closed quote, and Dunya Mijatovic, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, representative on freedom of the media, has called for an investigation to be launched into the journalists' deaths near Lugansk. Meanwhile, Russia proposed a new draft resolution on Ukraine at the UN Security Council Monday amid the worsening humanitarian situation and escalating conflict in the country's eastern region. Vitaly Churkin, who is Russia's permanent representative to the UN and this month the head of the Security Council, spoke with reporters after the session.
Well, as you know, we have been following in the Security Council the situation in Ukraine very closely, and of course, this is one of the priorities of the Russian presidency in the Security Council. Russia, over the past 2 weeks, introduced two draft resolutions on the situation in Ukraine, focusing on both the humanitarian aspect and the situation and the political aspect of the situation. And we're continuing to work actively on trying to produce a resolution which could be supported by the Security Council. In this context, after the introduction of our second draft resolution, we had the expert consultations, and we decided to come up with an updated draft, quite extensively revised, in some way combining the some components of the two drafts and also taking into account the comments which were made by colleagues. Some of them, in the course of our discussions, said that they needed to have more information about the situation, particularly in the crisis area in eastern Ukraine. So in order to provide that information, we invited Ms. Valerie Amos, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Coordination, to brief the Council, which she did by teleconference from Geneva. And we had a discussion of the humanitarian situation in eastern Ukraine, but also, of course, addressing some political aspects of the situation. To begin with, may I say a few words about the humanitarian aspect of the situation in my national capacity, of course. The situation in eastern Ukraine continues to deteriorate. Towns and villages are being shelled every day by heavy artillery, including rocket system Grad, tanks, and air force. Over the past few days, a hospital and a maternity ward were hit by artillery in the city of Slavyansk. A nurse was killed. Fortunately, the mothers and newborns had already been evacuated. In Semyonovka, three private houses were destroyed by incendiary munitions. A mine hit the central hospital. In Khimik, apartment buildings were hit. Yesterday, the city of Artemyevka in the Donetsk region was attacked by the Grad rocket system, which resulted in the destruction of 23 houses, a hospital, and a kindergarten. In Gorlovka, the Air Force attacked the local self-defense headquarters with cluster munitions. Buses with children evacuated from the war zone are being targeted. It is of particular concern that Ukrainian forces use unguided munitions and inhumane weapons. There is video footage that shows that incendiary phosphorus-containing ordnance was used by the Ukrainian Air Force against the town of Semyonovka in Donetsk region, which may be qualified as a war crime. Indiscriminate attacks on civilian facilities take a heavy toll on the population. Over the past few days, hundreds of people, including children, were killed in and around the cities of Lugansk and Slavyansk. For 10 days, there is no water supply in the cities of Kramatorsk, Slavyansk, Druzhkovka, and in the villages of the Volnovakha area. Civilian water supply facilities and energy infrastructure are deliberately targeted. According to ICRC, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk urgently need medical assistance. In a number of cities of eastern Ukraine, the Kyiv authorities have deliberately stopped the payment of social allowances, thus targeting the most vulnerable populations: old age retirees, pensioners with disabilities, people with disabilities. Thousands of civilians flee Ukraine to escape indiscriminate use of force by the Ukrainian armed units. 195 temporary shelters have been set up in the territory of the Russian Federation that currently house 7,860 Ukrainian citizens. Yesterday alone, 13,500 people crossed the border to the Rostov region of Russia. The total number of refugees who have stayed in Russia at their relatives' homes or in temporary shelters over the past 10 days reached 60,000, and more than 100,000 people crossed the border into Russia. 15,000 fled Slavyansk alone. Systematic kidnapping and torture of journalists continues, and not only Russian journalists. The standard practice is to make them kneel, threatening with guns, putting bags on their heads, and beating them up. The captors from the right sector threatened to kill the journalists of TV channel Zvezda and demanded a ransom of $200,000 from their relatives.
Western members of the Security Council said they will consider Russia's draft resolution. However, they said they believe there's no humanitarian crisis in Ukraine requiring the Security Council to take action. Iran and the so-called P5 plus one countries, the U.S., U.K., France, Russia, China, and Germany, held the second day of the latest round of negotiations over Tehran's nuclear energy program in the Austrian capital, Vienna. We have this report from Press TV's Kavi Tavwe.
Representatives from Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany hold a second day of nuclear talks in Vienna, Austria. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is leading the Iranian delegation, while the EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton is heading the other negotiating team. On Monday, the two officials had a working lunch before having a trilateral meeting with the U.S. Undersecretary of State. The talks are aimed at finalizing a nuclear agreement reached between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries last July. The discussions will continue until Friday. Correspondent Taha Imani joins us from Vienna to tell us about these talks. Well, Taha, we're looking at June 16th through the 20th. 5 days of talks, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. And I'm looking at this setting the framework or the groundwork, perhaps, for what's coming up for July 20th. So far, what do you have to tell us?
It's now noontime here in Vienna, and the talks, the plenary session of talks between the P5 plus one and Iran should be underway by now, as it was announced by the officials here. Before today's talks, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif held a meeting with the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yuki Amano, here at the IAEA. And yesterday, you might know, Iran's Zarif met with the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Catherine Ashton, and also he held a trilateral meeting with Ashton and America's second diplomat, William Burns. So, as you can see, intense diplomacy is underway here in Vienna to actually start writing the draft of a comprehensive deal between Iran and the P5 plus one to resolve the issue of Iran's nuclear program, and also a deal that would lead to lifting of all sanctions which have been imposed on Iran. So let me tell you what we are expecting today. We are expecting both sides to actually start writing some part of the draft agreement. We know that they have some differences over this issue, the difference over the issue of enrichment and the differences over the issue of sanctions. As you said, the July 20th deadline, which was set in the joint plan of action back in November in Vienna, is near. And although that deadline can be extended for another 6 months, I think both sides want to actually start writing some part of the draft deal so that they can extend the deadline more confidently until December. About the issue of enrichment, I've heard from sources close to the Iranian team that the Western side wants Iran to stop enriching uranium at 5% and with thousands of its centrifuges. But Iran wants to have enough enriched uranium at 5% level so that it can use in its Bushehr nuclear power plants and other power plants that it plans to build in the future. And Iran says the right to enrich uranium has been recognized by the P5 plus one in the Geneva Agreement. Also, the Western side, it seems, wants to turn the issue of enrichment into something symbolic for Iran, only a few hundred centrifuges maybe, but Iran wants to have that capability and wants to produce enriched uranium for its demands, for its needs. Also, it's the issue of sanctions. We are hearing that the Western side says that the sanctions following the comprehensive deal would be lifted throughout like several years, maybe 10 years' time. And Iran wants the sanctions to be lifted immediately. And it says if the sanctions are going to be lifted gradually, it will do its part of the deal also gradually, and it will not do its part of the deal immediately and all by one. So all in all, we are seeing that both sides are involved in intense diplomacy to get closer to a final agreement and to bridge the gaps that they have regarding different issues like enrichment, sanctions, and issues like research and the Iraq heavy water reactor, for which Iran has proposed some solutions, and it's waiting for the response of the P5 plus one for that.
Meanwhile, British Foreign Secretary William Hague said the UK plans to reopen its embassy in Iran after it was closed 2.5 years ago. London will establish a small initial presence in Tehran soon, he said. In a written statement to Parliament, Hague wrote, quote, "I have now decided the circumstances are right to reopen our embassy in Tehran," closed quote. Hague had reportedly discussed the matter with the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, on Saturday. U.S. troops are on the ground in Iraq. We have this from Press TV's Kovi Tavway.
Some 300 American forces have been deployed in and around Iraq to help secure U.S. assets as militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or the ISIL, have captured key cities. Up to 170 service members who have already arrived in Iraq are armed for combat, while nearly 100 additional forces are being put on standby, most likely in Kuwait. President Barack Obama says the troops are to provide security and support for U.S. personnel and embassy in Baghdad.
Meanwhile, the insurgent group, known alternately in the Western media as ISIS and the ISIL, is closing in on Baghdad. We have this report from RT.
ISIS emerged in Iraq right after the U.S.-led invasion and pledged its allegiance to al-Qaeda. Although the groups later became rivals, it has fueled the sectarian bloodshed in the country and proclaimed an independent Islamic State spanning Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. ISIS has thrived during the ongoing war in neighboring Syria after gaining access to money and arms flowing into the hands of the rebels there. And now, after growing into a huge force, the group is marching on the very heart of Iraq. Let's take a look at that. Earlier this month, the militants captured Mosul. That was a key victory for them. But ISIS continued to press south along the main highway towards Baghdad. Earlier today, at least 44 people were killed in clashes between the army and insurgents just 60 kilometers from the capital in Baquba. Joining me now is Dr. Oz Hassan, an assistant professor of Warwick at Warwick University. Thank you very much for joining us, Doctor. Now, here's my first question to you. Militants from the ISIS are closing in on Baghdad. How bad is this?
It's quite dramatic in the sense that what you will find is that if sectarianism spills out onto the streets of Baghdad, it's going to be incredibly hard to contain because you're going to have Sunnis and Shias fighting each other street to street.
Washington is sending a small, what they call a small contingent of troops to Iraq. How far will America go to deal with the sectarian tensions there? And can they deal with it?
That's an interesting question. Not least because the sectarian tensions in Iraq are part of a larger Cold War going on between Iran and the Gulf states, namely Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait. So the United States, if you know, it can send a protection force in to protect its embassies, and it can try to deal with sectarianism in Iraq. But unless it gets on top of this wider regional conflict, and namely, really starts to deal with its allies in the Gulf and stopping them spreading sectarian hate, then really, you know, events in Iraq are going to spill over into a much wider regional conflict.
Speaking of a much wider regional conflict, Tehran now has been is almost a key factor in this, with Washington saying that they could use some help from Iran, even the UK saying that they might resume opening up the embassy in Tehran. How key is Tehran in all of this?
Tehran is key. If you look at 2003, Tehran was actually quite active in its support for the for reconstruction of the Iraq war, but they were spurned by the Bush administration. The Bush administration was very keen to ignore their efforts. I think in this regard, getting Tehran on board to try and help decrease the sectarian tensions is fundamental. But at the same time as the United States, if it does go down that route and try that, it needs to be very wary of the fact that Iranian involvement is actually one of the key issues that has helped sort of alienate the Sunni population in Iraq in the first place. So it's a very difficult balancing act that the United States needs to pursue.
Can Iraq survive another invasion? I mean, the UN has warned today that this could be, Iraq could be on the brink of a much wider sectarian war. And Western powers don't, Western powers don't invade again, what's going to stop the bloodshed?
At this point in time, what needs to, the only way you can stop this is if, you know, the first premise needs to be that, you know, you need to recognize that it's not just ISIL or ISIS, as it's been also called, as the extremists in Iraq. You've also got 80 other Sunni Arab tribes made up under the Military Council of Tribes of Iraq. So there's a much, you need to recognize that there's a much wider variety of actors whose interests have all aligned together, and they are now working with ISIL and extremists, whereas previously they actually helped protect the Iraqi government. So in that sense, one of the first steps needs to be to get those forces who have joined up with ISIS, back on site with the Iraqi government, get the al-Maliki government to really recognise that the way in which it's promoted sectarianism is inappropriate and actually incredibly damaging. So in that way, there needs to be a much wider regional approach and a much more nuanced approach if this problem is going to be dealt with.
Tuesday's announcement of the capture of a man who was allegedly behind the September 11, 2012 attack in Benghazi that killed four Americans may bring a sigh of relief to the president and Democratic members of Congress facing re-election this year. The killing of the U.S. ambassador and some of his staff a year and a half ago has been a major talking point for Republicans ever since. But one person who knows about the Obama administration's involvement in Libya goes much deeper, former Green Party presidential candidate and six-term member of Congress, Cynthia McKinney. McKinney had been to Libya numerous times before and during the U.S.-led war there. We spoke with her via Skype on Tuesday. So the president has announced that they've captured the guy who did Benghazi, as they're putting it, and this has been a big Republican issue, attacking Obama for the entire time since the killing of the American ambassador and several others. And it has deflected totally any discussion of what actually happened in Libya. You were on the ground there during the aerial campaign twice, as a matter of fact, and you saw up front and close what happened. So what's the real story there?
The real story is that Libya does not function any longer as a governable state. And U.S. bombs, missiles, and the pilots who flew the planes and the helicopters and who dropped the bombs and the missiles are responsible for the total destruction, the death of a governable state.
Hmm.
In addition to, I would add, the destruction, the murder and the death of innocent Libyans who were doing nothing more than defending their country. There was one person that I met in particular who was the chief of all of the tribes. Libya has approximately 200 tribes, and this person was responsible for all of the tribes. That means that everyone had a voice through their tribe, or they had a voice and they had a voice through their workplace, through the revolutionary committees, very much like Cuba has revolutionary committees at the workplace. And so people had several points of interaction where they could not only have their voices heard, but make decisions that would determine how the oil money was spent. And that was through the committee structure as well as through the tribal structure. And it was the structure of the tribes that allowed everyone to have input into governmental decision-making. For example, was there going to be oil money that subsidized housing because everyone was guaranteed the right to a home? So was housing going to be subsidized, or were they going to apply additional subsidies to the price of oil that was charged at home, the price of gasoline that was charged at home? So these are the kinds of decisions that the people themselves got a chance to make, not their, you know, sort of stand-in representative who may or may not vote in the interest of the people. And in fact, Muammar Gaddafi wrote about the unrepresentativeness of so-called representative democracy in the Green Book. Right. But one of the things that the U.S.-backed regime of lawlessness that the United States calls a government of Libya, one of the first things they did was destroy all of the green books that were housed in the various embassies around the world and So that knowledge was lost, and that philosophy was lost for people who care to inquire. And then secondly, of course, the governance of the state. I would suspect that oil is being continues to flow, but the state of Libya probably isn't getting paid for it. And if the Democrats and the Republicans don't talk about targeted assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, which is a war crime, if they don't talk about the total destruction of the state of Libya, then they're not talking about anything.
Yeah, you were there when they were bombing. And in fact, we had spoken via Skype on one occasion where you were with the representatives of the African Union. You were describing how over a 12-hour period the previous day in Tripoli, you and the African Union reps had counted 83 explosions from bombs coming into Tripoli alone.
There were actually 89.
Oof.
And it was from 11 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. And yes, the African Union representatives were stunned by what they felt, because of course these were bunker busters and the earth literally shook. And the question was, how much more of this can the planet take? That was the concern, because they were coming so rapidly and they were coming so constantly that you know damage was being done to the constitution of the earth. You don't do this to the planet without repercussions.
Or without having another planet to go to.
Exactly.
Also, the bombing campaign began in March and continued until November. Tripoli had a population of about 2 million, which is similar to just Manhattan in New York City. And there have been four wars and a bunch of other skirmishes, the abrogation of the U.S. Constitution and all of that, with two airplanes hitting one building or one building complex in Manhattan. You have, from March until November, of this kind of bombing that you're describing going on incessantly in every Libyan city. What kind of impact did that have on the Libyan population, the people that supposedly the bombing was protecting?
Yeah, and that's a lie. And if the Democrats and Republicans reach an agreement that fails to investigate the totality of the Libyan situation, then they are involved in a cover-up. I'll just put it blankly that they're involved in a cover-up, because there's much more to the Libyan story than what happened on September 11th in Benghazi. And of course, that is very important because lives were lost there, but lives were lost from the beginning of the bombing campaign straight through. And those who were literally most affected were the children, who tried to maintain a normal lifestyle when the buildings in which they were going to school in were shaking, and windows were shattering. And this is something that happened every day.
Mm. Yeah, and you've visited some hospitals and the universities and other public facilities. What was the impact on all of those from the bombing?
Yes, it was. I visited a university that was bombed. Hospitals were bombed. Communications outposts were bombed. Homes, neighborhoods were bombed. Gathering places, known gathering places were bombed. President Obama and his team bombed everything that could move. And of course, we don't expect the truth to come from the media, because there were agents of the media who were sending tweets of civilian targets to hit. and those civilian targets were bombed.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.